Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome in to episode 105 of the House of L podcast. I'm Lawrence Holmes. Thanks so much for checking out the podcast this week. It has been, it's crazy. Like, this month has been one of the most downloaded months that I've had in a long time. And there, a big thanks goes to both Lance Briggs, who was last week's episode, and my buddy Rick Camp, who was nice enough to do some bull stuff for House of L, for which I paid him. And now he's launched his own podcast called Basketball Camp. And I thank him because he brought a whole bunch of ears to House of L. And I hope that you stick around and you stay. And it was very, very valuable, which is why I wrote the man a check. See, Campy, you can do it on your own if you want, baby. You can. I'm also excited because I've been sitting on a Spice Adams episode for about a month. And I think next week we will put it out for the public, for people. But this week was tremendous. I have a ton of affection for Peggy Kaczynski. I think she is a real badass. When it comes to doing sports in Chicago, she's a legend. She bristles at that, and she explains to me why I might think that she's a trailblazer, but she's not as much of a trailblazer as I think. But I think a lot of people have that same sentiment, and I'm glad that Peggy does a good job of kind of setting the record straight on that. You'll hear once you get inside of the episode. What I love about this episode is I think you get a real sense of how fun Peggy is. She's a serious journalist. Make no mistake. And we talk a lot about what's right and what's wrong inside of journalism and sports journalism in particular. But I think one of the things that comes across and came across on camera for her, clearly comes across on radio with her work on the Kevin Matthews Show, her work on AM 1000, her work nationally, like that stuff comes across. But on television, when you only have, whether it's a 4-minute newscast or a 90-second package, she was able to convey her personality through her stories. But don't get it twisted. This is the type of person that you wanted in the interview room after a Bears game, inside the locker room after a Bears game. Because Peggy knows her stuff, and the people around her knew that she knew her stuff. So this was great. Obviously, we're having these conversations now remotely. And I actually think that for this particular episode, it really lends to it. I haven't asked PK yet. I will. I'm going to ask her if I can put the video up on YouTube. But you'll hear her talking about what's going on like in her house. And it's great that how she's embraced being a mom, and as she would say, an older mom, and dealing with social media with her twin boys and her daughter. So that's all up in here too. If you wanted to know what those interview rooms were like with Lovie Smith, outside of my recollections of them, you're going to get Peggy's, and I think that that's important. There's a lot of good lessons in here. If you're a young journo, I would highly recommend that you share this with some people. Because Peggy knows how to do it the right way. And she did it for the right way for a long time. And we even talk about why she walked away. We get into that too. Great episode with a great person. Episode 105 with Peggy Kaczynski.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Woohoo!
Look at you.
Hey.
With all the new technology.
Do you remember the poker room?
Yes. That's where you're at?
Yes. So this is my studio setup now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I knew how to, I think if I just, if I had hooked up the phone to my,
your mic?
Board,
yeah.
Yeah. Then I could have just used the mic and it would have been much better for you. So I apologize.
No, no worries. This is fine. I'm looking at the levels right now. It's totally fine.
Okay. I got to find something to lean it against. And I'm opening my bottle of wine for the night.
Oh, this is top notch. This is going to be a classic episode then.
It can't be a Peggy After Dark without me, you know, having some wine.
No, I like, what kind is that?
It's Mont Rose, which is a Saint-Estèphe 2016 French Bordeaux.
Oh, fancy, yeah. Schmancy.
Hey, I'm cleaning out the cellar. It's rainy daytime. But I'm such a Polack that I put how much it's worth on the bottom.
Well, you got to know what the value is for sure.
So I bought it at Binney's for $35, and I zap it with the app, and the value is now $42. Look at me.
Look at you. You are making profit after profit after profit.
Oh, my God. This is just so funny. My wine cellar is completely organized now. I mean, completely. I can't tell you how much I've done in the last week that I've gotten done. It's crazy.
No, that's a good thing. I think that's one of the good byproducts of this is that we're being productive, yeah, in ways that we thought that we weren't going to be productive.
Totally. And well, it forces us because you can't sit there and go, God, I got nothing done. Over 2 weeks.
Yep.
I got nothing done. Like, there is no excuse.
Nope. You're 100% right. There's no excuse for that at all.
Yeah.
How are the kids?
Everyone's good. You know, it's kind of hard on them, to be honest. It's hard on Jason Jr. He's got a girlfriend. And so it's been really, really, I didn't realize how hard it would be. And then my daughter got a little emotional yesterday. You know, they hear everything on the news and, my husband Jason's company is still open, thank God, because they manufacture a commodity, which is electrical components, and they have orders for the hospitals to, you know, all those ventilators need, you know, cording that gets plugged in, and that's basically what they make. So he goes to work every day, and he's trying to keep everybody social distancing in a factory. So, you know, we all get a little nervous, you know, but I am just a maniac with the Lysol. I mean, I went to Walmart and I had my thing of wipes with me. And I actually, are you recording, by the way? Should we just like, are we just talking?
I can stop recording. I was recording, but
oh,
this
no,
is.
You're good. Good. No, this is good. I like, content is good. I get it. Content's good. So, but I, people were laughing at me because I was walking and I had a wipe in my hand and you don't realize how much people touch until you go. There was one of the footballers in Italy. I saw one of his tweets and he said that their highest contagion area is the grocery store. And he said, if I could teach anyone, you know, in the States what to look out for, please be careful in your grocery stores. So I literally was walking around with a wipe in my hand and everything I wanted to buy, there's no, you know, taking it off the shelf, looking at it, putting it back. Oh, this one looks better. I'll take this one instead. Like, you have to grab what you want with the wipe, wipe it all down. This was after I wiped down the cart, put it in the cart. Then when I was checking everything out, I wiped down the self-checkout. I wiped down the gun. I wiped down the credit card reader. And I mean, I wiped down everything. And this woman next to me was just looking at me like I was crazy. And I was like, hey, I don't want to take any chances. I don't want anyone in my family. I feel like I am, my moral responsibility is to my immediate family. And that means when I go out, I should also, you know, I got to help people that are around me too. So the woman that was giving me, looking at me weird, I go, would you like a wipe? She's like, thank you.
Yep.
It's like offering someone a piece of gold, you know?
No doubt about it. I mean, I did the same thing at the ATM yesterday.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, nope, screen, buttons, all of it.
Think about, like, you don't think about, you know, when you have kids, when they're babies, you're constantly using the sanitizer. Everyone that has a newborn baby, you know, you have to sanitize before you pick the baby up. But all that goes away when they're 4 years old and they have snot running down their nose. And then it's like, here, let me use my shirt to just wipe it off. You know, there's so much germs. And then you realize when your kids are like 6 and 7 and 8 that they have to put their hands on everything, every escalator, every staircase, everything there, the railings, everything. And you kind of become a little nauseous to the germs that they're exposed to. Well, now that we are at this weird, crazy, crazy state with this virus, you know, it's just, you find yourself being, like, I find myself being more than I think I ever was. And I thought I was borderline germaphobe before. And now I'm just, you know, I just would feel so guilty if I passed it on to anyone in my family or anyone around me. It would be horrible.
I think that anyone that is taking smart precautions, you can't blame them. You just can't. Like, the way that this is going and how it's affected everyone, it's scary. Like, it's a very, very scary thing. So why don't we talk about something a little happier?
All right.
So you're on TikTok now.
Oh my God. So I got to tell you why TikTok was on my to-do list, because I'm 56 years old and I have an 11-year-old daughter. So it's really easy to be the old mom. I mean, my daughter would say things like, Mom, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, Mrs. Carey, it just had her birthday. I'm like, oh, how old's Mrs. Carey? I love her. 39. I'm like,
oh my God.
I'm like, oh my gosh. And we do all of we do a trip with all our neighbors when everyone turns 50. I'm like, the last person turned 50 this year. I'm closer to 60 than they, you know, were to 50. I'm like, oh my gosh. So I always think about something that Chris Berman, Boomer at ESPN, used to say. When I worked with him in Bristol, Connecticut, he really struggled with computers. So this was in like 88? I want to say 87, somewhere around 87, 88. And the ESPN newsroom had just gotten computers. And they were the big, like, clunky. And before that, everyone typed on the old typewriters. And so your scripts had like 5 sheets to it. And you typed really hard. And Boomer was like a hunt and peck real hard, you know, typer. And the yellow was for the director. Pink and blue were for the 2 anchors. You know, green was for the floor director. You know, and then the last sheet was for the teleprompter. And you literally fed each sheet into the teleprompter so that they could see it. And back then, you know, teleprompters went down all the time because it was human error. You were just, you know, you got the pages screwed up or whatever. Well, Boomer absolutely refused to do computers. And he still did the old hunt and peck on the old, you know, typewriter. And I remember thinking, you know, back in the 88, whatever, I thought, oh my gosh, I can never be like that. I can't be that person that if you don't change with the times, you will get old really quick and you will be left behind. So, you know, when Twitter came out, I jumped on it. I didn't necessarily understand it right away, but I feel like I was doing it fairly early, you know, for the media, 10, 12 years ago. I don't know how long ago Twitter came out, but so TikTok, I thought, okay, I don't understand. Like, I'm watching The Rock and Kevin Hart. They're two of my favorite people on social media. And I'm like, fucking, is it 10 to 20 seconds of just talking and then it goes away? Like, I don't get it. And yet then there's all these dances. So I just said to my daughter, okay, teach me TikTok. And so she says, okay. But I go, okay, teach me a really easy one, okay? Just teach me an easy one. Well, she teaches me Renegade. Do you know Renegade?
I do.
Holy crap, is it hard. It was really hard. And I had foot surgery a week ago Monday. So I was on day 4. And I was still gooped up on God. And I'm trying to learn Renegade, the dance. And my teenagers are walking through, they're laughing. They're like, no, mom, it's like this, you know. No, it's figure eight, like this. You could do the worm. I'm like, yeah, I can do some of them. But, you know, everything is, I guess, really close and tight to the body. That's what I have to learn. So it took about an hour to learn Renegade. And then I said, okay, I think it's time I needed another one. Moves. Clap 4 times slowly. And then this is the very first move. I just couldn't even get it. It was like, she was making fun of me. She's like, no, what are you doing? I'm like, well, what does it matter if, you know? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's challenging, but it's fun.
Can I make a suggestion for your next TikTok video?
Go on Google and make sure that go on YouTube and learn it first.
No. I think that you should reverse it on your daughter. I think you should teach her a dance that you used to do and see how long it takes her and then put that on TikTok.
Okay, wait, so can you do like any dance? Can I bring back, you know, Staying Alive?
Yeah, I think that's what you do. Like, you do something that is completely foreign to her and then teach it to her and then put that on TikTok.
Yeah.
Just reverse it.
You know, because I could get the two teenagers involved in that too. I love that idea.
I think you just...
All right, game on. I'm going to do that.
All right, good.
What have you done on TikTok?
I haven't joined TikTok yet.
Oh, come on. Get all the cool kids are doing it, Lo. Come on.
All right, maybe I'll jump on TikTok. So I almost got tempted when I saw that Rita Wilson was doing rap lyrics on Twitter, and then Sarah Spain did a song. I thought about doing that, and then Goff was like, everyone who's not a rapper, please stop doing rap music on Twitter. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that at all. He's 100% right about that.
I saw that going around. You know what? I saw that going around, but I didn't open it. I saw the Rita Wilson and I saw Sarah Spain, but I didn't open it. Is that what they're doing? Are they lip-syncing?
No. They're doing it. Like, so Rita Wilson was listening. And so like the idea is that she's sitting there reading a book. And then she heard a song by Naughty by Nature, and then she just started rapping along to it, and she picked like the most difficult part, and she nailed it. And so everyone, it basically became like the Rita Wilson challenge, like pick your favorite rap song and then act like you're reading a book and then do your deal.
Okay. Yikes. That could be a little scary.
It could be.
You know, especially,
she pulled
some white people. Some white people shouldn't even be trying it. It's like, let's be honest.
I think that's what Jason was saying. And I think that he was right about it. And then I was like, you know what? You're old. Maybe you shouldn't do it either. And I was like, okay.
Okay. Although, Lawrence, so, you know, my two boys are 17 and hip hop is their genre. It is the most popular genre. It has surpassed country. It has surpassed pop. So, when I'm trying to understand them and still try really hard not to sound like my parents, I got to tell you, I listen and I'm like, okay, wait a minute. This is not hip hop. This is pop. This is pop. A lot of the hip hop today, so they don't want to say they're pop because it's not cool. So they say they're hip hop, but they're it's pop. And the other thing, I'm really, really sorry, but my biggest hang up right now is with Lizzo. Okay. Like, stop yourself already. She can sing, but you've got to get to like the middle or the end of the song before she actually carries a tune. The beginning is so bad. It's like so many hip hop songs. It's out of key. It's out of tune. You know, oh, but you can hip hop really fast. You can talk really fast. You can rap really fast. You know, I want to say stop it. You can sing. Just sing. It drives me crazy. Every time a Lizzo song comes on, I'm like, that's not singing. Like, if go to the end of her song, she starts singing.
She can sing and she can play the flute. So it's like, why don't you do those two things?
She has musical talents, but it's almost like she sells out the opposite way, that she has to be a hip hop artist because that's the cool genre, you know, not what she does. So I'm just saying, these are thoughts from a 56-year-old stuck at home during COVID-19. And if it goes on any longer, I'm going to be 57 pretty soon.
I like that you are offering the advice because, you know, hey, from different perspectives, that's where some of the genius stuff comes from. So it's not that crazy. Let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to when you said gooped up on GOP, like I immediately thought back to like Kevin Matthews.
Oh yeah.
Like I like that. That's a very Kevin Matthews or Jim Shorts saying. So
yeah.
Back in those days when you were surrounded by a bunch of crazy people on the radio, what were those days like?
The easiest job I ever had. The hardest part was actually getting up because I was working at CLTV and there were nights when I did the 10 o'clock news and the studios were in Oak Brook and I lived in Lincoln Park and I would get home at midnight. Oh, but then my friends would be like, oh, you have to meet us on Rush Street. You know, we're all at the hang up, you know. So I'd be like, okay. So I would get home at like 1 a.m. and then I had to be on the morning show. I had to be ready to go on the air at 5. So I would ride my bike and I'd leave my house at 4:30. And I would get there at like 10 to 5. And then just rip and read. But the thing with Kevin is, you know, we talk about it with athletes. When you are geniusly skilled at something, it makes everyone else around you better. And Kevin is such a genius, comedic mind that he totally laid out the carpet, made it easy. They were layups for me. The whole group I worked with, Jelly was the producer, Kevin, Doc was our engineer, God rest his soul. We had such great chemistry that it was like hanging out with your friends. Oh, and Pugs. I can't forget Pugs. We just had great chemistry. And it was funny. We all knew the timing was great. We didn't step on each other. Nobody tried to take over a show. It was Kevin's show. He knew when to bring people in, to bring in your character. I used to tell people, don't believe everything you hear. It was theater of the mind. There were times I was at home on the air when I was trying to get pregnant and I had thrown my back out. And so I was on a mic at home, an ISDN line. And I don't know who called in, a doctor or someone called in, physical therapist, and said, you know, roll a ball on your back. That'll get the knot out. Well, now, you know, we use rollers all the time. But back 20 years ago, that was a very novel idea. And so I pretended like I was laying on the ground and it was, oh, oh, oh yeah. Oh, oh yeah. Yeah. you know, and I'm really just sitting there with my cup of coffee going, oh yeah, oh, oh, oh yeah, you know. It wasn't, but people said, you know, some of the skits we did, that they would drive off the road laughing. It was just our own personalities all meshed with each other, and we just kind of got it. It was the most fun I have ever had and got paid for. I mean, just so much fun.
Yeah, that seems like a hard thing to chase, where if you have that early enough in your career, and then you're like,
yeah,
am I ever going to find something like that ever again in this business?
Well, especially when you kind of switch and you turn gears and you go into sports on the news. Now you have to be a little bit more serious. And I had to kind of sell my reputation. I had to set my reputation up as a serious journalist after these years of being goofy on Kevin Matthews' show. And so you can't do both right away. You have to really kind of lay the road, and you have to like pave it so that once people respect you, you can start showing your personality. You know, you can start making comments at Lovie Smith press conferences. You can show your personality more. You know, it's really, really hard. I think it's easier today for people to just show who they are, but then you have to pick a lane, and then that's your lane. Not many people are able to do a lot of different things. Serious journalist, stupid, goofy, funny, sarcastic comedian, stuff like that. So it's, you know, back then I was aware enough to know that I had to convince the audience of my credibility to do sports and to be believed and to be taken seriously, and then to also have fun at the same time.
Do you think about how radio prepared you for doing television?
Oh my gosh. I remember when Frank Whitaker, the vice president of news at Channel 5, they were looking to bring in a freelancer, and they decided they didn't want to hire someone regularly. And I had been sending them tapes since college. I would drop off a tape constantly because I interned there. I interned under Warner Saunders, and I was constantly dropping off tapes. And, they finally said, okay, we're going to give you a shot. David Kaplan, Peggy, and Tom Thayer. We were going to be the Bears reporters, but we would take turns. And I took it as competition. I was like, okay, Tom had all the knowledge, but really didn't want to do the daily kind of stuff, didn't want to have to go in and talk to the players, you know, on camera. He really didn't want, like, he's perfect in the lane he's in, and that's as a game analyst, right? Cap at the time was doing college basketball coaching, and he had like a scouting service or something.
Yeah,
I can't remember, right?
Yeah,
he had some kind of like scouting service, and he ran like a camp and stuff, and so he had the contacts. He, you know, had that going for him. And I kind of felt like I was just going to outwork the three of them and just get things done. And I kind of think that's what I did. I made myself so available, constantly new ideas, going in and talking to players and doing sit downs, and came up with different ideas for stories, tried to be creative, you know, and I just kind of flooded them with these ideas. And when Frank Whitaker, when they decided to hire just me after this experiment, he said, you can tell you do radio because whenever we have a breaking story, you can just talk. And that being able to talk off the cuff it's golden for breaking news. And every time we had any kind of breaking news, I was able to just talk. And so I learned to just talk, but get in there all the key information you need to pass along in your report. And it was the best thing I ever did. And the other thing is, radio gave me credibility. It was a long format. It was hours upon hours a day that you're talking. So you prove your credibility over hours a day, as opposed to a minute and 15 every day, mm-hmm. which was what TV was. So in a minute 15, you either are really good on camera or you're giving good information. You know, those that are good at both, you know, that's not instantaneous. You have to develop your audience. And I was so lucky that I got my credibility from radio first.
When it comes to you having to deal with, in a lot of cases, for a long time, you were the only woman doing sports in Chicago on television. What were those moments like when you were the other, you're different?
Yeah. So I just had this conversation. I had Kate Scott, who did the play-by-play for the all-women's broadcast of the Blackhawks and Blues game on International Women's Day. So Kate Scott came on my podcast, The Sportscaster and Her Son, and I said, hey, Kate, this was halfway through the interview, so I wasn't, there was no dissing, there was no disrespect at all, but I said, you know, how do you feel when people say that you're such a trailblazer? Now, obviously, they made history. Though people didn't pay attention during the Olympics, there were all women teams covering women's hockey, even in the truck. But they didn't get the same kind of, I think, publicity behind it. NBC Sports put a great publicity arm together. And Kate Scott and I talked about that on the podcast. And she said, you know, she said, it drives me crazy when people say I'm a trailblazer, because I know that there's all these women ahead of me. And yet she's a trailblazer for what she did. You know, they did make history. Absolutely. And there's still not a lot of women doing play-by-play. So when people say that I was the only one doing sports as a woman in local television in Chicago, I was sitting at CLTV when my coworker, Amy, got hired, Amy Stone, got hired away from CLTV to go to NBC. She was at NBC, I think, 12 or 15 years before I was. Nobody remembers it.
I forgot all about that. I remember Amy Stone.
Jill Carlson came in after Amy left. Jill came and worked with me at CLTV. And then Jill left and she went to Fox. And so Jill was doing sports at Fox. Trying to think who else. There were a couple of women at the old, what was the old NBC Sports Chicago called?
Comcast Sportsnet.
Comcast Sportsnet. Thank you. There were three women. And I considered that doing sports to a broader market than I was doing at CLTV. They were all, you know, Gail was over there. They were all over there doing it. I don't know what happened when I went to Channel 5. I don't know if it's because I have a bigger mouth. I don't know if it's because I have a bigger personality. I took more risks, I think, for sure. I definitely took more risks. My success became big. And I think that, by no means, I was not the first, and there were people before me. I say it all the time that in the 70s, you know, people always forget Jeannie Morrison's doing it. And Jeannie Morris was at Channel 2 and Channel 5. But a lot of people forget that, and they think that, oh, well, she was married to Johnny Morris, the Bears wide receiver. No, she was the journalist in the family.
Right.
You know, she wrote Brian's song. She was the true TV person. It's just funny, Lawrence. It's just who people remember. And I think I embraced all of the media that was available to us. I was going on radio shows while I was at Channel 5. You know, I embraced, you know, Twitter and Facebook. And so I was doing everything. And I was kind of like just probably shoving it in people's faces, and that's why people either, you know, loved me or hated me. So I appreciate the success, but there were like others who absolutely got hired before me and were on television doing sports at the local side of a network affiliate in Chicago before me.
How did you handle the criticism that women face in television that men kind of don't?
I was never pretty enough to be accused of it. Hey, you can slap lipstick on a pig.
Oh, would you stop? Get out of here.
Honestly, like, seriously, Lawrence, like if people saw me with my hair up and stuff, I don't think I ever have been accused of being the pretty girl. So I never thought of myself that way. Therefore, I never carried myself that way. And if anyone ever said you're only up there because you have, you know, boobs, I'd be like, wow, thank you for noticing that. Like, thank you. Because no one ever hits on me, you know? Honestly, that just isn't me. That's just not, it's not me at all. It just isn't. So I never even put myself in that category. The only thing that I will say that I think is when the athletes would, you know, hit on you or be disrespectful to you. I have 7 brothers. So I kind of treated them like I would my brothers. It was kind of an F you back, you know, like, seriously, dude, you know, do your job next week and maybe I'll be over there talking to you in your stall. So I kind of just gave it back to them. There wasn't a lot of that. You don't know what you're talking about. You know, there really wasn't. Listen, I didn't know what I was talking about. I covered it up. And I got called out a couple of times, but that's okay. You know, that's what part of the job is can you learn on the fly, learn the job, and improve from there on. I mean, we all make mistakes. You know, it just took me a long time to get over the mistakes.
I think that's a really interesting point that you raise. It's almost like people think because we cover sports that we're somehow experts in sports. And to a certain degree, like, we have to learn some of the expertise of it. But it's not that you're an expert in sports, go be a reporter. There's some learning that takes place. And sometimes I wish that coaches and athletes that we cover understood that better. And that's something that, yeah, we're asking questions because we don't know the answer to it. And right, a lot of times we get accused of, well, you know, like, it would happen in press conferences with Lovey all the time. Like,
yeah,
well, you know, well, no, I don't. That's why I'm asking you. So how about you just give me an answer to the question so that I do know and I can add it to what I already know and become a smarter and better reporter.
I think, you know what, Lawrence, and you teach, so you understand this aspect of it. When I was in college in the early 80s, I was taught you have to be right. You can never be wrong. You can never be wrong on the air. And that was exactly how television news started back in the 50s. Like, you were the authority. You had to be right. And I think at some point in the 80s and 90s, when it changed was when we started talking more than about, like, the X's and O's, and news became more about everything from politics to religion to health to legal contracts, financials, with collective bargaining agreements. It became of everything. And you need to be knowledgeable in everything. You need to know how to find the information, and you need to be very careful of presenting it in an accurate way. But in the end, we still make mistakes. So I think that what I always found, like, I always felt like I had to be right, I had to be right, I had to be right. And towards the end of my career, I realized that it's not so much about having to be right, it's about relating to the people at home and And if you don't understand something, you say, you know, I really don't understand this offense. Can you explain it to me? Because that's what the audience at home wants to know. And the more you can relate to your audience, we're only the conduit to the audience and to the athlete and the teams. And so there are times we ask stupid questions, but we ask them for a reason. I remember one reporter even called me out in a press conference at Hallis Hall when I asked the special teams coach when they stopped the wedge. And the rules stopped allowing you to do the wedge, breaking up the wedge on special teams in the NFL. And I said, can you explain that? And another reporter in the room turned and looked at me and said, well, you know, it's when they, and my eyes were like, I just looked, I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, I said, no, I know it, but I need the coach to say it for my soundbite. I need him to say it for my story. It doesn't do me any good showing them how much I know.
Right.
I need the coach explaining it in his words for the audience. And so sometimes we ask stupid questions for that reason. Sometimes we ask questions just for a reaction. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, there's a lot of, and that all comes with your experience in the field, you know, and understanding there's a lot of different reasons you're asked. Sometimes you're asking a question to set up the next question. You know, there's a lot of reasons behind it.
Yeah. And the asking questions to get the bite is something that I think a lot of people in the audience don't necessarily understand. And again, I go back to being in the room with Lovie Smith. Like, yeah, I know exactly what you're getting ready to tell me, but right. I need you to say it because you're the coach of the Bears.
Exactly right.
Me saying it doesn't do any good. You being the coach of the Bears makes all the difference in the world.
Exactly right. And if people read their newspaper articles and pay attention to where the quotes are, those are our sound bites in radio and television. Those are the sound bites that we are using in our stories. So the writers, you know, whoever they may be from the Tribune or the Sun-Times or the Daily Herald, they use the same sound bites that we do. And what sometimes we get looked at as being the dummies, you know, it's like, oh my God, you guys are so stupid. And it's like, well, it's all how we have to write around the information that they're giving us.
Let's talk about you and the one-on-ones, because I've always, when it comes to trying to figure out how to do television interviews, I think that you're one of the best that's done it in our business. What's your approach to putting together like long form sit down interviews with people?
So hard. Tell me what you liked about it. Tell me what, because I'm super critical. I'm like, I would never go back and say that I was really an A at anything. I was always very, very critical and thought I could always do something better and change it. So I'm curious, as a member of the media, when you've watched a one-on-one that I did, what was it that stood out to you?
I like that you were always good at figuring out the tone of the interview. If it was a player who didn't do their job, your tone was perfect for that. If it was a fun one-on-one, like, your tone was perfect for that. If it was a serious sit down where you were genuinely trying to get information from someone, that your tone was different for that. And I always loved that you walked in and you would have your pad and you would be like, this is what I'm getting done today. So I want, like, what went into your process of getting that type of reactions from the subjects of your interviews?
Gosh, you know, you nailed it with, I was always aware of what the topic or the athlete or the coach, like, you have to really, one of the things with not being in tune and being in the know, I think it's being in the know. You know, sometimes in television, we can't possibly use as much information as the beat writers get. And you can either take the easy way out and just be like, well, I don't need it. So why would I, why do I need to sit there for a Jerry Angelo information session with the beat writers when, you know, my station's never going to give me the time to use it? And I would say it will make you a better reporter. It will make you understand more about background information. If you go into an interview and you ask someone, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, the COVID virus, people are taking this so seriously, and you don't realize that maybe the athlete you're interviewing had a family member that was either a paramedic or, you know, a first responder, or maybe, you know, had a death in the family recently. You're like, you have to be really aware of as much information as you can possibly consume to understand what you think you're going to get. Now, you have to be open enough to know it can change, but you have to at least go into it thinking this is going to be tough on them. You know, they had a tough year last year, or this guy's on the chopping block. Jerry Angelo basically said it on a, you know, in a background information session. David Terrell, you know, here's a guy, was he their first round draft pick?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, things like that, where you stop and you say, okay, I'm going to go into this, and I know that this year is going to be it for him. And so there's got to be a little bit of seriousness to it. So I guess I just really try to always be so in the know as much as I could, because that comes through in the interview. And when they realize that you know some things, they give you better information. They give you better answers. And now the audience is going to find out maybe one thing that they've never known before. And that should always be, you know, the goal of any story or interview. Give them, let them walk away with, this is the information age. I mean, people can find out everything. We need to give them something they can't find out. So be a good interviewer. Be someone who's really in the know and tries to just absorb as much information as possible.
How did you go about building your credibility in locker rooms?
You know, it's funny. When I first started at CLTV, Glenn Kozlowski said something to me. He was playing for the Bears. And for those who don't remember, I think he was number 88. He was special teamer, tight end. And he was like watching me in the locker room. And he asked me, he said, did you ever play sports? And I thought, uh-oh, here we go. It's going to be the, you didn't play, you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, yeah, I was an all-city basketball player here in Chicago. I was like second team all-state. I played volleyball. I played softball. Actually, I kind of played everything. I have seven brothers. Yeah, he was, yeah, I could tell. I could tell you're an athlete. I could just tell by the questions, the way you ask the questions, like you understand what goes in and you understand what, you know, might come out. And so, you know, he and I were talking about that. He's like, don't ever lose that. And I was like, yeah. And then he said to me, I don't know if I should even say this. This is a little bit on the edge. That's okay for the podcast.
It's okay for the podcast.
Okay. So he's like, oh, you played basketball. And I said, yeah, I did. I played basketball. And he said, really, did you play in college? I said, no, I blew out my knee in a city tournament and then state when I played for Resurrection High School. And he said, oh, you're not lesbian, are you? I said,
what?
No. I'm Polish. And so that was my way of kind of like diverting the conversation from what could have been really like just like, oh no, here we go. And he said, okay, that was the best laugh I have had in such a long time. He said, that's the other thing you can never lose is your sense of humor. And so that was kind of just taught me when I worked the locker rooms. Just remember what it was like to be an athlete. Be inquisitive and don't lose your sense of humor. And, you know, if someone like Olin Krutz would give us a non-answer, I would kind of give them the eyebrows and be like, what was that? Like, that really wasn't an answer, you know? And he would just kind of laugh and be like, okay, great. All right, Peg, you know? So yeah, it was just, I don't know. I think it's just my personality. I just kind of learned, you know, use everything you have.
I really enjoyed.
You think people are going to be mad about this?
No, I think
my Polish story.
I think that's going to be a fun laugh for people. I think that that's a great way to answer that question, to tell you the truth. I'm sure Kaz will like it too. Like, that's a funny story. I loved covering the Bears while you were covering the Bears. We had very different relationships on the microphone with Lovie Smith. Like, mine was very antagonistic and adversarial. Yours was not, unless it needed to be. And yeah. And then when do you know to turn it on and to turn it off? Because I feel like if I could go back to that version of myself, I would be more mindful of the adversarial approach that I sometimes took. Like, I still wear it as a little bit of a badge of honor because, all right, so I got a Lovie Smith story. Can I tell you a Lovie Smith story?
Yeah, for sure.
So we're at training camp down in Bourbonnais, and you remember how they used to have the bikes, like Lovie started the whole bike thing?
Yeah.
And so I'm standing out there. I was listening back. Like, I had interviewed someone before lunch and everyone else had kind of gone into lunch. And I'm standing out there by myself and Lovie comes up and he goes, well, I see you with all your friends. And I said, yeah, and with all your championships.
Oh, 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 you did it.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, wow.
But in, wow. Yeah, so that would happen a lot. Like, I would get after it with him a lot. And in press conferences, this happened a ton. I always liked that you asked pointed questions. You did it with a smile until you had to not do it with a smile.
Yeah.
So where did that come from?
Well, you know, at some point in my career, I really started to love the digging for a story. And what I found is I wanted to be more like the beat writers, but in TV you can't, because you have to cover every team. You have to cover the Cubs, the Sox, the Bears, the Bulls, the Blackhawks, the college teams, you know, high school. But I just craved like information and the truth. And I think like as I became a veteran reporter, I realized when we were being fed a line, and I did not want people to look at me as like, you really believe that stuff that they say to you, you know, because I started being able to see through it. And it bothered me when they assumed that the audience was so, I guess stupid can be harsh, but
naive,
for lack of a better term, naive, that they're going to believe whatever the coach says, right? And at the same time that we reporters just write down whatever the coach says. And I think that with Lovie, that's where we started to, we started out great. And then obviously as things got tougher towards the end of his career, he got more defensive and he really tried to be defensive in his, you know, a lot of, I'm the coach of the Chicago Bears kind of answers. And it really wasn't good enough sometimes. And I, you know, listen, I used to keep a quote from, I want to say it was Bernie Goldberg. He does HBO Real Sports.
Yeah.
who used to say, you know, if you haven't pissed someone off as a journalist, you're not doing your job. And the point is not to be adversarial and to be, you know, aggressive and go after people. The point is to just try to get the truth. And don't be afraid to ask for the truth. Because in the end, we all want transparency. As sports fans, we want transparency. And I really got it. Like, I got the fact that teams tell you what they want you to know. And, you know, it wasn't good enough when prices were going up for tickets and, you know, the amount of money being spent. Like, I always felt that the fans deserved the truth. And so I kind of really dug that going after, you know, like, the truth is okay. It's okay to give the truth. And it, you know, it worked. Listen, Lovey and I would say we probably have a good relationship now. Not, you know, I'm sure he's still angry about some things. I'm sure he feels like the media got him fired. But I think overall, you just want your entire body of work to be what they judge you on. And I think overall, you know, he's called me in the principal's office. He didn't like, you know, I would roll my eyes at the press conference, and that drove him crazy. And he would call me out after the cameras were off, call me in the hallway. So, you know, I was disrespectful sometimes, and other times, you know, I got some good advice where, you know, PR guys would be like, hey, this isn't talk radio. You know, you need to decide, are you a talk radio host where you can just throw everything out there and it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, be backed up by anything, you know, or are you going to back it up with facts? And so I thought, okay, this is interesting. And so I really tried to find a balance and find the balance of what people want to hear, what they deserve to know, and, you know, what makes interesting conversation. Like, when you go home and you're like hanging out and at home, is this, what are you going to talk about? Are you going to talk about, oh my God, did you see what Lovie Smith said today? Or did you hear, you know, like, that's a little bit of what I wanted that. I wanted people to be talking about it.
All right. I got two more questions for you, and I appreciate you being so gracious with your time.
Oh my God. This is going to be like, this will be our epic episode.
Look, this is what I love to do for House of L. Like, I love to do this, like, so I can really talk with people. And now you're on what, your second glass of wine?
No, it's still the first. Look, it's just not much left.
All right. Well, this one's a more of a technical question. How did you deal with, because when I was working at Channel 5, this is the shit that drove me crazy. You spend 4 or 5 hours putting together your 4 minutes. You get it. Jeff Glick's yelling at you. Dave Breyer's yelling at you. You get everything that you get done. And then they go, we're going to need to take 20 seconds.
Oh, okay. Lawrence, I came from ESPN. I was the producer. You never cut a package without discussing what the importance, like what you need to cut out. Like at ESPN, that was disrespectful. It was really hard for me to get used to at the local level, that you just turned your stuff over and then you watched it on the air that night and they might have cut out 20 or 30 seconds. I had many, many screaming matches where I said, at the very least, call me. I can tell you what doesn't need to be in there, but because you need to save 20 seconds and that soundbite was 20 seconds, that was your convenient cut. That was the most information of the entire story. Like, you don't take that part out. And so it drove, like, I thought about every detail of my packages. I thought about the rate of a dissolve. Do you want a slow dissolve for the emotion? Or can you just do a quick cut because you're just going from one thought to the next? I thought about what type of transitions we were doing between shots, because I wanted the audience to actually not realize why they were thinking something. Was this comedic? Was this not? This is information that nobody else has. This has to be in there. He did not say this to anyone else. You know, it drove me crazy. And I understood why local news can get such a bad rap, because it comes down to we need to save 20 seconds. We needed 20 seconds. So I had to cut 20 seconds out. And it's like, it can ruin your reputation for what the point was you were trying to get across. And I never dealt with it well. They can tell you I was a bitch. I was a bitch when it came to, you cut my stuff out. Like, we are going to talk about what, because listen, I was obnoxiously, I really owned my stuff. And I really wanted them to realize, like, they didn't get this over at Channel 7. Like, I got this. I know that they didn't get, the Tribune didn't get this. Like, this short little bit has to be in there because it's that important. And I even had, as an example, one point I did in one of my stand-ups. It was one of those, ooh, gosh, we don't have a lot to go on today. And the more they make everyone get the same information, the same press conferences, the same availability. I was in the Bears locker room and Jay Cutler had walked through the locker room. He was just cutting through with his food. And he looked over at one of the wide receivers and he's like, oh, glad to see you're playing, you know, Happy Sack or whatever it's called. He's like, you need to be in the film room working on your routes. And I heard it. And I was like, And so I did a quick check. Oh, targets. 4 targets last week, 1 for 4 the week before, 1 for 4 week before, 0 for 3 week before. And I was like, ooh, I can turn that into information. And so it was something so teeny tiny small, but I used it in my stand-up and came out of it with a graphic of this wide receiver and the last 4 games. And I had one of the Tribune reporters said to me, that is the kind of information that people don't realize is information. The fact that you picked that up just from standing here in the locker room, everybody else is standing here just kind of doing nothing. He said, that's what made that story stand out. And so that's what I just tried to always kind of, you know, show them is, you may think it's stupid and inconsequential, but it's not. It's being observant and you know, don't take it too far and don't make it what it's not. But is there something to this? You know, so that's what, you know, my mind was always like, which is why I needed a much needed rest, because it's like a rat being on the wheel. When I wake up in the morning, I still get up between 4 and 5 every day. My mind is just like going like that.
Well, it used to drive me crazy with the live shows too. Like, that would drive me insane, where we've cut it as deep as we can cut it. Like, now you're talking about like no establishing shots and stuff.
Yeah.
Because we need it for weather or for whatever story, like, because sports is usually at the end of a show, we're usually the ones that would end up getting the brunt of that. And it used to drive me insane.
Yeah. And it is a fight in local news today. Is telling a story, establishing the story, telling the story, and getting information in there that others have not already given out, making your story stand out. That is why it's so challenging. When people are like, oh my God, local news, it's so easy. Yeah, you're right. It can be really easy, or you can really find it very challenging because you only have, on average, a minute 10, a minute 15 to get the story out there and to try to make, how is my story going to stand out from someone that's watching Ryan Baker on Channel 2, Mark Giangreco on Channel 7, or Dion Miller or Megan Mowicki, Dan Rowan on Channel 9.
Corey McFerrin on Channel 32.
Corey on Fox or Luke Canellis and, you know, all the – something has to make people want to tune you in. There has to be something. And for me, it was information. I was trying to get information. It was, you know, I'm not going to get them to tune in for my looks. I'm getting them to tune in for my information. Trust me on that.
So are you happy having walked away?
Yeah, I am. I think there's never the right time. I feel like I understand athletes even more than I thought I did understand them before. You know, was it the right time? It was probably early, maybe too soon. But the reality was, Lawrence, I could not go to work every day. I hated it. I was mailing it in. I wasn't putting any effort behind my stories. I absolutely could have stayed. My contract was up right after the Cubs won the World Series. And I was like, what am I doing? I don't like that drive that I loved. I love the thirst for information. It was thwarted. The teams were getting tougher to deal with. More restrictive. I had personal issues, all of that stuff. And I thought, well, you know, I've always told people, don't be that grump. Don't be the one that's bitching about the industry. You know, you got to walk away when it's time to walk away. And yeah, it hasn't been easy the last 3 years. It'll be 4 years. It hasn't been, but I think, you know, trying to find what is going to drive you when you're in your mid-50s. You do not have the same energy you did in your 20s where you can work 4 and 5 jobs. Well, maybe you do. but you just don't have that drive. I had a really good friend. I asked for a good year before I did it. I asked a lot of friends. I have a lot of friends who are older than me, a lot of friends who are younger than me. And so I asked my older friends, you know, how did you know when the right time was to retire? And they were all men. There was no one answer. But one friend of mine said, you know, everybody goes back to work after 1 year retired. Everyone is like, this is like, I can't handle it. I'm going back to work. And so I knew I should keep a door open and ask NBC, will they just keep me in the loop for stories to work a handful of times a year? Because when he said that, I'm like, yeah, I could see that happening. So I'm going to want to still work some. Trying to find what's going to fill the void is the hardest thing without realizing that the clock is ticking on life, you know? Mm. Like, when you're 25, it's like, oh, my God, I would kill to have all that free time. You know, well, you have your whole life ahead of you. When you're 55, you're kind of going, oh, geez, you know, a year's gone by. What have I done? You know, yes, I realize like the time with my family is invaluable. Of course it is. But I'm not going to be that idiot, you know, that's like, oh, I wanted to spend more time with my family, realizing that two teenage boys really don't want to spend any time with their mom. So, I mean, that's just being realistic. Have I spent more time? I've seen everyone except one of my daughter's gymnastics meets, which when my boys were playing baseball, I was literally running in the middle of the game, jumping on the ice and how we're getting to the Blackhawks when the puck dropped. I'd be running to try to get to, you know, volunteer at school. And then I'd get to a Cubs or a Sox game in the third or the fourth inning and try to catch up, you know, up on what I missed. So yes, I have spent invaluable time at home. Trying to find what's going to fill that void is an everyday process. I took voiceover classes for a year and a half. I set up a home studio in my basement, started a podcast with my son. That has been the most like work that I have done. I'm working on a couple of other ideas that I've always wanted to do. I've thought about these since I was in my 30s, and I'm like, well, why am I not doing it? Some of those athletes that I interviewed over the years, I now have a different relationship with them. It's friendly when I see them. I run into them on the golf course. We end up talking about what they're doing. So many of them are getting into broadcasting. They always ask me for advice. I find that I like to talk about my theories on broadcasting. So, you know, I think I'm probably going to start consulting.
Good. And,
you know, I don't know how much I can help people, but I like doing that. So, and I'll be honest with you, you know what I miss the most?
What?
What do you think of all of it? Like, everyone always says the camaraderie. And yes, I do miss the camaraderie. Trust me, I miss the media rooms and the sarcasm and the competition. I miss the competition for a story. But you know what I miss the most? I miss a paycheck. I'm going to be honest. Okay. I have worked since I was 11, 12 years old. I always earned my own paycheck. Always, always, always. And my husband's wonderful. And he's the one who encouraged me to retire. And yes, I am fortunate. But there is something very prideful in earning your own money. And it's something that the old Polsky and me from the northwest side of Chicago, just, I'm not good with. I'm not really good with. Like, I need to be able to have earned my own way. So that's the only thing that I have not come to terms with.
Well, PK, this was extremely informative. And
I know. I feel like I owe you money. Like, I just had a great couch session that you're like.
Well, no, I mean, this is exactly the whole reason that I do this podcast, is because I know that I'm learning, and I usually share a lot of this stuff with my students. Like, I let them hear some of this so they understand what they're walking into, because
right.
Plenty of them see the finished product on the air and they have no idea everything that's underneath it.
Yeah, I know. There was a really funny tweet this week that was going around, list your five jobs that you've had, you know, and then tag five people. And when you look at people in the media and the jobs that they've had, I was laughing so hard, because I want to tell my son, who's decided to go to UT Austin to pursue sports broadcasting. And I told him, listen, buddy, like, you're going into an industry that you don't make money for a long, long time.
Long time.
And you got to really love what you're doing. And you take whatever jobs you can get, you know, to pay your bills. And I'm reading what some of the other media people wrote as some of their jobs. Dion Miller worked at an Amish restaurant. Like, what? So, I mean, yeah, it's really like, people need to realize that it's like anything. This was our goal. And we're all the survivors. We're the ones who made it. But not everyone does make it. And that's why it's like, and that's with any industry. People fall out of every industry because of the challenges. And it's, you know, the strong survive and keep your eye on the prize.
Well, thanks for this. And I'm looking forward to, I hope that you implement my TikTok idea, because I love the idea of, like, you teaching your daughter the Charleston.
Lawrence, what the fuck, man? I'm not 80. I'm not 80. The Charleston. I don't even know how to do the Charleston. Like, bring it up at least to the Bee Gees, okay?
All right, the Stayin' Alive thing. I think that's where
Michael Jackson, like the Bee Gees, Donna Summers, and then go to Heart and Fleetwood Mac and all that. Like, that was my formative years. Okay?
Do you think that your daughter knows what the moonwalk is?
Yes, because she asked me I saw her working on it, and I actually showed, well, because, you know, the last couple of years, the whole Michael Jackson, when he died, I had to tell my teenagers too. I'm like, you guys don't understand. He was the king of pop. He was the biggest name in music. And so the boys were understanding because they were 14 and 15 when Michael died. My daughter was younger, obviously. She was like 8. And then now she's 11. And I see her trying to moonwalk in the kitchen. I said, oh, no, no, no. I said, you have to pick 1 foot up. You have to pick the whole arch up. And she looked at me and I showed her how to moonwalk. She thought that was the greatest thing in the world.
See, that's something that goes on TikTok. Like you got to flip it on its head and you got to show the young people what's up. That's what it is.
Oh, see, that's a great idea. She could totally like do, you know, a renegade move. And then I bring back a Michael Jackson move. And then, we'll have to work on it. Listen, if this COVID goes any longer, you're right. That's what we're all going to be superstars on TikTok.
Well, wherever the camera is, that's where we got to go.
And still not making any money.
Listen, no.
I had a friend of ours said, gosh, this COVID-19, he goes, man, he goes, why is it 1 week in and I'm on my second outing to the store to buy 2 weeks worth of booze? It's like,
yep.
And another friend goes, this is like Las Vegas in my house. He's like, the booze is flowing. I'm still losing money and I have no idea what day or time it is.
Yeah. You know what? Like for me, the weekends have been the hardest. Like during the week, like I still have my routine and I'm still doing the radio show. So that makes sense. Saturday and Sunday, I have no concept of time or what I'm doing.
I know. It's crazy. It's going to be, I think we're all going to come out. We're going to come out on top. There's going to be a positive everyone. I really do. I really believe that everyone's going to be, you know, more empathetic to each other.
I hope so.
Less self-absorbed. And, we're all going to realize that we all kind of went through something together.
But not before you put that TikTok out.
Yeah. All right.
I look forward to us sharing a space together again soon.
For sure. Would love it. Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you so much for doing this. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
All right.
Well, if you were ever wondering why all of Peggy Kaczynski's coworkers just adore her, you found out why listening to that episode. She's just great. She gets it. She's a lot of fun. She is embracing being the mom that is now doing dances on TikTok, which I don't know if I would have ever guessed, but you can never put anything past Peggy. She's an absolute legend. I loved hearing the stories about her talking about working with Kevin Matthews, who's someone that I need to get on this podcast. I don't know if I can handle talking with Kevin Matthews because I'm such a big fan of his. It would be like me getting Dahl on the podcast. I would probably fanboy out a little bit, but that's okay, right? Like that's allowed. You don't mind that when I fanboy out on some of this stuff. And Peggy's just, she's just dope, man. Like it's hard for me to even describe like how helpful she was when I made my jump to television. She was really helpful in teaching me like how to take some of the lessons that I learned from radio in crafting a story and then figuring out how to translate that to television. Her and Paula Ferris, and you should go back and listen to the Paula Ferris episode. It's a few episodes back. Her new book's coming out, as a matter of fact, this week. So it would be a good time to revisit that conversation. Because I just got Paula's book and a really nice note in the mail. But those two women played an instrumental part in me wanting to continue to do television. Because I saw how they were doing it and they did it the way that I wanted to do it. So it left open possibilities for me that I didn't think were even there. But Peggy's the truth, man. She's the absolute truth. And you're not going to find anyone that has a bad word to say about her. And they better not say it in front of me. If they do have a bad word to say about her, we're going to be fighting. Thanks so much for listening to the episode. I'm debating whether or not I'm going to do something for House of L for the Last Dance. Probably owe that to the LoHo Daily podcast, but we'll see. Maybe I can do a little bit of both on each. Still got some great episodes to come. Man, I had a conversation with Erica Clark, a.k.a. Mr. T's daughter. I got to get some of this stuff cleared through legal before I can even put it out. But it's so good. Thanks for listening. I appreciate your support on the House of L podcast. Thanks to Peggy Kaczynski. And check out her podcast that she does with her son. It's really, really good. The Sportscaster and Her Son is the name of the podcast. They get big names on, too. I'll talk to you next week. Peace.
Get all the MasterForce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with MasterForce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with MasterForce power equipment at Menards. Save big.